we're doing the second case. CQ standing for certified question. This one from the North Dakota Supreme Court. Mr. Weiss is representing Wolfgang Mao and Ina Mao, and will appear at the podium. Ready.
Wolfgang Mao, my co-counsel from North Dakota, Dwayne Lillehog, who I've only dealt with by phone and has been a delightful gentleman, had hoped to appear here today, but in light of the recent activities is unable to fly in and offers his regret to the court in that regard. It's always a privilege to appear in front of the court. But I realized over the last 2 days how I take that privilege for granted. And in light of what's been happening in the country for the last couple of days, the privilege is enhanced of being able to appear in front of the court in a country where we have a rule of law, in a building like this, where we have an open democracy. And I can't begin to tell you how much that has struck me over the past 2 days. And how appreciative I am of the opportunity, which is, I guess, fairly unique in history when we really think about it, to have these kinds of institutions that we do so take for granted. I haven't been involved in this case from day one because it's a North Dakota case, and I've been involved in the preparation of the briefs and read them last week on a plane on the way back from Texas again, and was struck by how complicated some of the issues are here. But the more I began to look at this issue, the issues presented in this case, it really boils down to two, I think, relatively simple issues that the court will have to grapple with. And once we decide those two issues, everything else falls in line. First issue, I think, and the one that I'm going to raise first, even though it's dealt with last in the brief, is whether or not Mr. Mao was an occupant. And the second issue that I think is of great importance is whether or not he was a named insured. I think that once those two issues are decided, and if either of those two issues are decided in favor of Mr. Mao, then I believe that the conclusion is inevitable that there is coverage.
Well, counsel, the certified question asks us a specific narrow focus, essentially, and it seems to me to assume for purposes of asking the question that he was a named insured, at least if he's a named insured, is this thing valid? But if we answer that, in fact, under Wisconsin law, which is a question they didn't ask, that he was an occupant, for all intents and purposes, if this was a Wisconsin case, that would end it, because we don't have to decide whether he's a named insured. So I guess I tend to agree with you that this is the way that we should begin the analysis. But don't we, even if we find that he's an occupant, don't we have to go on and answer the question that the court asked us?
Well, I don't think so. And the reason that I say that is if we take a look at the certification of the North Dakota court, I think the court made it absolutely clear that this court was to have free rein on these issues. And frankly, that's the way that it's been briefed by both parties. Because at the very end of the certification, they say, we invite the justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court to reformulate our question in any way they deem appropriate. And then they go on to say, we do not intend anything in this certification to limit the scope of inquiry. So I believe that the way both counsel have approached this issue is to treat it as if it was arising for the first time within Wisconsin, because I believe that that is exactly what the North Dakota court would like us to do. And I think that when we do that and we look at the occupancy issue, frankly, I think that we can send this back to the North Dakota court with a clear answer on that issue, which then will necessarily answer the coverage question.
Okay, but the problem that I find there, and I'd like you to address it, is that on page 8 of their certification, paragraph 13, they say Mao has not shown he was occupying or using the rental car under Wisconsin law when he was injured. One interpretation of that is that the North Dakota court has already determined the question of whether or not he was an occupant.
Yes, but again, I think that we have to remember that at the very end of the certification, we have this very, very broad language that says, listen, this is really a Wisconsin decision. You can reformulate this. We're not intending to limit the scope of discovery, and we're not intending on making any explicit findings that cannot be, I don't want to say overturned, but they want the guidance of this court. And frankly, from a very practical perspective, if in making that decision, if that's what they did, that he wasn't an occupant, if they're wrong, since Wisconsin law controls, certainly this court ought to give North Dakota the guidance of the fact that they believe that the North Dakota court was wrong in making that determination, because Wisconsin law does apply, and I don't think that there's any dispute about that.
If we are to be so free-wielding in coming up with our question rather than their question, why don't we say Dan Beck controls? Now, and what effect, if we said Dan Beck controls, what effect, if any, would the Dan Beck decision have on this case?
Well, I think that if in fact this court finds, as I believe that it should, that Mr. Mao was an occupant, I don't think that it has any effect whatsoever, because if he is an occupant under the terms of the policy, then clearly there would be coverage. When we get to the issue regarding named insured and other issues, then Dan Beck could have an effect.
If he is an occupant under the terms of the policy, what policy are we talking about?
We're focusing on the policy in question, I believe, would be the EP policy, the Extended Protection Policy, which, as I recall, was the Extended Protection Policy came into effect because he bought the International Extended Protection Plan, which then included the Extended Protection Policy.
And is the provision that we're talking about within that policy an underinsured motorist provision?
Yes, I believe that it would be, since there is liability insurance that was paid on behalf of Ms. Mashburn.
Can Dan Beck be interpreted for the proposition that if you settled for $715,000 out of $1 million with the liability carrier and don't exhaust the full limits, then you're not entitled to underinsured motorist? Can it be interpreted for that premise?
I don't believe so, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and obviously I haven't focused a great deal on Dan Beck with respect to preparation for this argument, but I believe that here there are two underinsured motorists. Certainly, there's the underinsured motorist for the county, I believe it was Cass County, that insured the patrol car that paid the $715,000. I guess it wasn't clear to me in the reading of that whether that payment was made on the basis of liability or whether that was paid on the basis of underinsured.
Is there an exhaustion clause in this policy?
I am not certain whether there is or not. I did not see one in preparing for this, but I have to confess, Justice Sykes, I did not look for one. I'm trying to remember in the general kinds of commercial policies whether or not that clause typically exists, and I'm just not certain whether or not it does. But getting back to Justice Bradley's specific question, there was exhaustion with respect to Betty Mashburn in any event. And I think that since there are two separate underinsured motorist policies here, I believe that, but I'm not certain, that under Danbeck, that exhaustion of the one policy would certainly entitle you to collect on that policy, and that perhaps you couldn't collect with respect to the other policy, but there has been exhaustion of one policy here. So I think that probably would take it out of the rubric of Danbeck.
Didn't we send that Danbeck question back to the court to clarify, and they said essentially, don't bother with it? I don't refresh me.
Frankly, I don't recall.
Well, they did. But of course, the original certification said do whatever you want. If we accept that argument, I would just like to note, it says this court can reframe the issue. It didn't say counsel should reframe the issue. And that this court did not reframe the issue. That is not meant as a criticism to counsel. They did what needed to be done to argue this case as they saw it. But the question that was certified could be read as something different, but go ahead.
I think that on a very practical level, we'd be doing a huge disservice to the North Dakota court if this court, for instance, on the occupancy issue, was not to advise that court as to how this court viewed it under Wisconsin law, particularly in light of the broad language. And we certainly would be doing a disservice to Mr. Mao and the litigants here.
Let's talk about the occupancy issue for a minute. I know that's where you started, and I'd like to hear your argument in that regard. Apparently, you're arguing that Mr. Mao was vehicle-oriented, and therefore he was an occupant. Is that correct?
Correct, and that's been the standard in Wisconsin for many years.
Doesn't that approach come into some question when you have an individual who's actually occupying another vehicle?
I don't think so, simply for this reason. That is, it would strike me as curious if the serendipitous fact, let me back up for a second. I don't think there's any question whatsoever under Wisconsin law that had Mr. Mao been standing adjacent to his vehicle, waiting for it to get pulled out of the mud, and he was hit by Ms. Mashburn, that there would be coverage. I just don't think there's any doubt about that whatsoever. So the question then becomes, is the serendipitous fact that instead of standing immediately adjacent to the automobile, that he's some 60 feet away on order of the police officer, who's obviously trying to keep him safe, is that serendipitous fact something that causes Mr. Mao not to be covered here? And I think if we look at the standard, it's not. The question is whether or not he's still oriented to that vehicle, whether he still intends on using that vehicle, and whether he's out of that vehicle for reasons that don't have to do with not intending to use the vehicle.
So, counsel, that would mean, let's say, instead of being in the vehicle, the officer's vehicle, there was the officer said to go to the restaurant along the road. So he's 60 feet away, and a car crashes into the restaurant, would that be the same? He would still be in the occupancy?
I think it would be, because...
Does that sort of a stretched interpretation, wouldn't you think, of what, but you're saying as long as you intend to reoccupy the vehicle, then no matter where you are, right?
Yeah, no.
So would it depend, and the other thing is, what if I said 847 feet? Would that make any difference? I'm just saying, where is the stopping point in close proximity? And that's the question I have.
Yeah, and that's a fair question. And certainly at some point in time, there are some facts at which the court would say that you're not vehicle-oriented. And let me give you the example that I had thought of. And that is, let's say that Mr. Mao's car is disabled there and that they can't get a tow truck there until the next day. So that Mr. Mao ends up having to go to a hotel, and while he's at the hotel in the parking lot, he gets hit by a vehicle there. You know, we can extend the logical limits further and further and further, and at some point in time, certainly there wouldn't be coverage. But here, I think the orientation to the vehicle is very direct. The only reason that he's sitting in the squad car is because his vehicle is disabled at the time, and he has every intent of immediately returning. And in fact, I think that the evidence here is very strong that but for the fact that the police officer directed him there, he would have been standing adjacent to his vehicle waiting for it to proceed. So it seems to me, and perhaps I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me that if we do follow the case law that's been adopted in Wisconsin, and we do use the vehicle-oriented test, that certainly Mr. Mao qualifies under that. Now, there's been a bunch of case law cited by the respondents here, but all of that case law involves jurisdictions that use far more restrictive standards, and there are two different standards that are out there in the United States, but Wisconsin has always used the broad one. And I think that really does make sense. It makes sense because Wisconsin does have a policy of trying to extend coverage to protect people where possible, and certainly in this kind of situation, where the only protection that an individual would be expected to have would be the rent-a-car protection.
Also, the other thing that perplexed me, but in the other vehicle, of course, he's subjected to other insurance. And in this case, as Justice Bradley indicated, there was the recovery under, you know, $750,000, and she asked the damn question, but it just would seem to me that when you're in another vehicle, but you're saying, well, it's because of, he was in the other vehicle because this vehicle had difficulty. But if he was in another vehicle, and let's say he broke down and there wasn't anybody there, but someone picked him up, so now he's driving to 27 miles to town, would that be also the proximity? Would that come in because he's in the other vehicle because of what happened to his vehicle? He's still pretending to occupy
it. And again, you know, and we can find examples where at some point in time we would probably cut it off.
But I'm trying to.
Yeah, but in my judgment, if somebody's intent is, if we use this test, if somebody's intent is to return to that vehicle and to return to that vehicle relatively soon, that they are vehicle oriented then, and they do provide the coverage. And in the example that you gave, for instance, I would say that, again, it's a matter of interpretation of the law, but let's say that somebody is riding to a gas station in order to get help. I think that, yes, then they are covered under the vehicle-oriented test because the only reason they're doing that is to take care of their vehicle. They're intending to return. They're intending to reoccupy that vehicle. If, on the other hand, I think that, for instance, if Mr. Mao's car had been completely destroyed and it was obvious that it was not drivable, then I think at that point in time, he is no longer vehicle-oriented because he's not going to be able to return, and that broad test would not apply.
And the proximity hinges upon the circumstances in which he left the vehicle. Because if it can't be an intention to return, necessarily, because of, you know, if you park the vehicle and you go away for 3 days and then you come back, you're intending to use it, but certainly that would not be covered, right?
No, that's correct. I agree with that. If you did park the vehicle and you're off doing something and planning on returning to the vehicle at a later date, I don't think at that point in time that the coverage applies. But here, and in many of the cases that we've cited, in fact, there's a case I think almost exactly on point, I believe it was the Utica case, where in fact the facts were that there was a police car about 100 feet away. The person ended up walking over to the police car, I believe, to give the license and registration, and was struck at the police car. And in that situation, the court found under the extended coverage that that this person was an occupier under the broad test.
Mr. Weiss, as I understand your position, Wisconsin law applies to define what's occupant under the car policy.
Correct.
And that occupant is defined by Wisconsin law includes your client.
Correct.
And that is the end of the case, if we agree with you.
Absolutely.
And Section 632.32 has absolutely nothing to do with the case.
Nothing whatsoever.
Even though the certified question was they wanted to know specifically under 632 validity. So, okay, let's move on to the other one, which might have been in the mind of the North Dakota court, as to what effect 632.32 has if your client is not an occupant.
Okay. Well, first of all,
that's the next question.
Yes.
As I stated. Okay, thank you.
Okay. First of all, I think that it's very clear, and I think it's clear when you read the briefs, that if, in fact, Mr. Mao is a named insured, if he is a named insured, then I think that there is coverage. I think Blaise Koviac simply applies at that point in time, and there is coverage. And let me just briefly go through that.
There's coverage under the policy itself.
There's coverage under the policy itself.
Because.
Okay.
I would assume that you're saying because it's an invalid clause.
That's correct. That's correct.
Under 632.32.
Yeah, I found myself a lot reading these briefs chasing my tail.
Okay, but that sounds like what they might have had in mind.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, and while there is language in the policy that says the policy only applies if you're occupying, that occupying language is invalid if you are a named insured. And so, I think one of the critical questions that this court has to decide is whether or not, in fact, Mr. Mao was a named insured. And let me give you my practical analysis of that and then my legal analysis. This case really...
To make sure, you're saying we don't have to reach this if we don't want to.
Absolutely not. I mean, I think what this court should do, frankly, is I think this court should say Wolfgang Mao is an occupant under Wisconsin law, therefore there is coverage under Wisconsin law, plain and simple. I think that's the clearest the clearest and most correct ruling that this court could give, so I don't think we need to reach the...
Mr. Weiss, if we were to do that, are we to be concerned at all with the other part of the question that's being asked by the North Dakota court, but only while the Alamo vehicle is being driven by the rentee lessee?
I don't think so, because again, I think that if in fact he is an occupant in the vehicle under the second tier of that, there's a three-tiered endorsement, and I believe it's the second tier of that endorsement. If he's an occupant in that vehicle, then I believe there's simply coverage. Doesn't matter at that point in time whether he's driving or not for the purposes of the underinsured coverage.
But if he's a named insured, then you don't have to worry about that as well.
That's my belief as well, because I believe that Blaise Koviac ends up dealing with that. You know, we have to get down the chain of analysis, but if he isn't named insured, we have to do that. And let me just tell you both practically and legally how I feel about that. These cases, when I first read them, were confusing to me, and I finally realized that really this situation is fairly unique and has not really been dealt with in any of the cases. And the way that this is different is you've got a bunch of commercial cases on the one hand that say that a named insured doesn't get anything, or an occupancy insured doesn't get anything under the policy. And then you've got a bunch of cases over here that say, well, a named insured is obviously entitled to coverage and these types of exclusions are not valid. Mao does not neatly fit into either of those categories for one big reason. And that is these commercial cases, including some rental car cases that have been cited by the defense, all involve situations where the renter didn't pay for this extra protection. And that really makes it very, very different. And I think that from a practical point of view, that's very important. Because what happens here is that Mr. Mao buys this protection. It doesn't come automatically. It doesn't come as a part of the contract. It's not something that Alamo just bestows gratuitously, which is the situation in some other cases. Mr. Mao actually buys this coverage. And when he buys this coverage, and he knows it's with National Union, because that's right in the documents that are provided to him, and the only thing that he has indicating the policy is the rental contract, which has his name on it. Now, it seems to me that on a very practical basis, that makes it very different from these other cases, these commercial cases, where the person that was seeking the coverage never bought anything. Instead, they were gratuitously, so to speak, covered by the commercial policy.
But why is he not a so-called occupancy insured as opposed to a named insured?
I think for a number of reasons. First of all, because he is the guy that bought the policy. That coverage, and the proof of the pudding there is simply this. If Mr. Mao had sought coverage here and hadn't paid the premium that Alamo demanded, he wouldn't have had a chance. That's unlike all of these other commercial cases where these people were automatically protected under a policy that they didn't buy. So I think that's number one. Mr. Mao bought the policy. The policy would not have existed but for his affirmative action in buying it. I think that makes it fundamentally different. Number two, endorsement one says that he's insured. It says that very, very clearly. It includes someone who bought the EP protection. Now, it qualifies that by saying when you're occupying the vehicle, but if you are a named insured, that occupying restriction is invalid. So endorsement number one says that he's a named insured. And I think that those two things, along with a couple others that I'm not going to have a chance to mention now, clearly
really indicate that he's... I mean, in the practical world, or what went on, the named insured was Alamo. I mean, under the policy.
I do disagree with that. If you'll take a look in the footnote of our brief, we really set that forth. They keep saying that the named insured is Alamo, but when you look at that, it says named insured, and then it says refer to endorsement one. And when you refer to endorsement one, it specifically says that someone... who buys the EP protection, extended protection, and that's how it defines it. So I believe that within the policy itself, that Mr. Mao was a named insured by definition, and we do deal with that explicitly in a footnote. I believe, Justice Wilcox, the footnote is in the reply brief rather than in the substantive. You see, my red light is down, so I will...
Thank you, Mr. Wise. Hearing no other questions, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Wells, representing National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Patrick Wells from Milwaukee, and I am here representing National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was my intent this morning to focus on and start with the issue of the named insured, and I would, prefer to continue in that regard because I read the certified question and the decision of the North Dakota Supreme Court differently. If I understand their decision, they recognize that this issue of occupancy is a settled issue in Wisconsin that is not an uncertain question of law here, and it was for them simply the application of that law to a set of facts. And they were not incapable of concluding that Mao has not shown that he was occupying the vehicle under Wisconsin law.
Do you agree that Wisconsin law applies? I read something that there was a dispute at one time between the parties that there, as to which law applies.
We are here today, and I discussed this with Attorney Heary, who was handling this case in North Dakota, because I guess we've conceded that the issues to be resolved here are covered by Wisconsin law.
Okay.
And if I believe the North Dakota Supreme Court concluded that he was not occupying the vehicle, the reason that that court, as I read the decision, sent this question to Wisconsin, which seems to be somewhat of an extraordinary measure, is that they could not understand how the issue of the named insured and the application of Section 632.32 might be handled by the Wisconsin courts.
An issue that had been debated in the trial court?
In all honesty, I don't know.
Okay. Was it briefed and debated in the North Dakota Supreme Court?
I've read all the briefs, and it's been some time, and it appears that the parties went through various stages of summary judgment arguments, and the arguments evolved throughout the case somewhat and changed.
How highly unusual, Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. And so I will just say briefly that I, in response to remarks made by my both my adversary, the other counsel here this morning, his reading of this occupancy issue is that there is this intent to return, and it's a recharacterization of this vehicle-oriented test, and I don't think that that's an accurate representation of the test or characterization of it. I think the test is, when you're vehicle-oriented, is really what is the person doing? That is what the court is looking at. Is the person, under the language of the policy, getting in or getting out of, getting on or getting off of? And all of the law is here.
Let me break in here for a moment on that argument to try to focus it a little bit. Do we even get to any court-created test, whether it's a test that looks to vehicle orientation or some other court-created test, when the term occupy is a defined term in the policy?
Apparently we do, because most of the cases that we reviewed, including Wisconsin cases, Kreuzer, Moherick, and Sentry, all, as I understand it, evaluated similar standard policy language, which says occupying means getting in or out of or getting on or off of, or something similar there too.
Does that make any sense, though, when that kind of policy language is plain and unambiguous on its face?
Apparently the courts have concluded that it is not plain and unambiguous on its face, and have maybe add additional evaluation or interpretation as to what does it mean to be getting in and out of. And so, for example, in the Kreuzer case, there what the person was doing was, they're characterized by the court as beginning to enter. They were in the boarding process. So the person is now left the sidewalk and is beginning to enter the car, that is getting into. In Moherick, similarly, the person is still touching the bumper of the car. The car is stuck off the road, but they are pushing the car, so they have not left the car.
They've already gotten out of the car. They've gotten out of the car.
They have gotten out of, but they have not completed the act of getting out of the car, because it is not their intent to do anything other than just simply push the car to the ditch and get back in. And then in Sentry, there is language that the person had not completed the act of alighting from. And that is where the person gets out of the door, walks around the back of the car, and then is in the front of the car, and the person has not completed the act of alighting from or getting out of the car.
So what do we have? Now we have, you heard the questions that I asked opposing counsel, and we got into some far-fetched places, I'm sure. But so we have an orientation test, and now we have what? What is this, a touching test?
Or no, it is.
It's still the proximity to the vehicle, or getting in or out of the vehicle test.
I don't think it is a proximity test. I think it is vehicle-oriented test, meaning what is the person doing? What is their act? and the courts have distinguished between vehicle-oriented and sidewalk-oriented. And I don't think your examples were far-fetched. There were similar examples that I was going to submit to the court this morning. If the person gets out of the car and is still on the street, they are vehicle-oriented, they're getting out of. But as soon as that person steps onto the sidewalk and heads towards the McDonald's, they are now sidewalk-oriented.
What if there's no sidewalks? I mean, this is a highway, right?
This is a highway.
There aren't any sidewalks.
There aren't any sidewalks in this case.
So what do we substitute for sidewalk to determine where you draw the line?
In this case, I think the person has to somehow terminate or complete the act of alighting from the vehicle.
Well, how do you balance that against the language that I frankly find quite persuasive in the Moherick case? And in that Moherick case, this court said, or at least adopted, it seems to me, the language from New York, which said that a person has not ceased occupying a vehicle until he has severed connection with it, when he's on his own without any reference to the vehicle. You would agree that, at least in this case, Mr. Mao did not sever his connection with it because he was certainly planning on going back to it.
I would agree with that, but this morning
I do agree with it or not?
I agree with that he has not severed any type of mental connection at all.
Okay.
However, I have not severed connection with my vehicle because I need to return to Milwaukee sometime today. And I think that
in that language we talked about vehicle oriented as opposed to being highway oriented. I don't know what that means, but in any event, here it's pretty clear this is different from you standing here and then returning to your vehicle, whereas he's got to stand somewhere while he's waiting for his vehicle to get pulled out of the ditch so he can continue on his journey.
I would akin the getting into this vehicle more like the example of going into a bathroom or a restaurant or some other place. He is no longer walking away from his vehicle. He has completed the act, and he is now in another vehicle. And I don't suggest to the court that it is impossible to occupy two vehicles at the same time. I think it is distinctly possible under Wisconsin law if he was between the two cars, because he's in the act of getting out of one, and he's in the act of getting into another. But once he has completed that act and gotten into the other vehicle, he has now terminated his getting out of process of that other vehicle.
What if he hadn't gotten into the other vehicle but was simply standing by it?
I think he is probably covered under both policies.
And he's covered.
I think so.
The act of opening up the door and sitting down in the vehicle was sufficient to extinguish. Does that make sense to you?
It does.
Why?
Because he is in another place now. He is no longer getting out of his vehicle. He is now going away from his vehicle. He is somewhere else. I mean, we can put a whole host of examples on it. In each one of them, I think the result is the same. Whether he's in a bathroom or a restaurant or another car or a trailer or a truck, he's gotten out of and he has completed the act of getting out of his vehicle.
With the due respect, counsel, whether you agree with the standard that our court has set forth in prior years, there is a standard, right?
Yes.
Association with a vehicle, or however you wish to phrase it. You think this court would take a certified question from another court to apply a standard to a fact situation? That's what these cases are about, aren't they, all the three that you cite?
Applying
a standard, right?
And I submit that perhaps this could have even been a jury question in North Dakota, and that's why I started my comments by saying I don't think they intended to send this question here.
If you want further discussion about that, you might read in the current article in the Wisconsin Law Review as to what's a jury question and what's a non-jury question in interpretation of contract. I think it was by Professor Whitford. So, in fact, we sent back a case to the federal court where we set forth the legal standard and said you apply it to the facts. Okay. I think it's hard to decide what is or isn't occupancy. It's line drawing, right?
Yes.
Line is either 10 feet from the car, 30 feet from the car, and the restaurant. Okay. I find it even more difficult to understand named insured and the relationship of 632.32. So if you'd enlighten me, that would be good.
I believe that this is an interpretation.
Is that the question? Is that the legal question you see before us?
Yes, whether we couch it in the way that the North Dakota Supreme Court has done so, or in a different way, the essential question is, does Wisconsin law prohibit this policy from defining its insureds the way that it has? And I submit that the answer is going to be no. This is an interpretation of a contract case, and I want to remind the court of the obvious, but we are to read contracts as it would be read by a reasonable person, to seek out the intention of the parties. And when there are unambiguous terms of a contract, we're to apply them as they are stated in the contract. Therefore, this court, in order to find for the MAO, must strike out the contract in its entirety and rewrite it. And the Mullenbein case also tells us we should also consider the type of insurance provided when we are analyzing the question of an interpretation of a contract.
What kind of insurance is provided here?
There are two policies provided. Elmo purchases a policy from National Union.
I'm talking about the EP, ended protection.
What is described in that's a product that Elmo sells. But when we're talking about the policies, there are two policies. There is an underlying policy, and there is an excess policy. And in Wisconsin law, section 344.51 requires rental companies to either have a policy of insurance that carries the financial responsibility minimums or have on file a certificate of self-insurance. And so in this case, Elmo has a policy of insurance providing minimum financial responsibility limits. In addition, they also have an excess policy. And the excess policy, we need to be sure that we're talking about the right endorsements and everything when we're analyzing this. The excess policy begins at the appendix. Make sure I give the right page. On appendix 185, that's where the excess policy starts. And it is a follow the form policy. In other words, it says we provide the following additional coverages, but this simply follows the form of the underlying policy.
What and is the extended protection? Reading from the certification, the decision, rather, of the North Dakota Supreme Court. Extended protection. If purchased, EP provides UM protection.
They've called it the EP, and that's the product that Mao bought from Alamo. But what it does is when you buy the EP says you have, okay, for this small additional fee, and maybe I shouldn't characterize it as small, that's a relative concept. For an additional fee, you have purchased the right to be considered and insured under the excess policy. If you don't purchase any of these products, you're still covered under our standard policy because state law requires it. And keep in mind that state law requires not only financially minimum liability limits, but by operation of section 632.32, is it sub 3, but with the purchase of that liability for each one of its renters, Alamo and National Union's policy had to include uninsured motorist coverage. So there were minimum coverage available to Mao just by the fact that he was a renter and Alamo was insured as opposed to being a self-insured entity.
Tell me what's wrong with this. And again, I'm looking at the North Dakota decision, which sets forth the provisions of the extended protection contract, I guess. And it says, Appendix 103, if purchased, EP provides UM protection. Number one. Number two, under Wisconsin law, UM protection is personal and portable. Therefore, number three, to the person, and if it's portable, even if you're sitting in a caterpillar next to your car, I'm talking about a piece of equipment.
Or as the courts have said, on a pogo stick.
Okay. That's right. I remember that decision. It's personal and portable. So, under the terms of the extended protection contract purchased by the insured, EP provides UM protection. In the state of Wisconsin, UM protection is personal and portable, and therefore, wherever you go, it follows.
In Wisconsin, UM protection is personal and portable to the named insured in an owner's policy of insurance. And that's where I hope to go and convince this court. My argument is that Mao purchased the right within a contract with Alamo to have access to this policy of insurance, but Mao is not an owner of a vehicle described in any policy of insurance. He does not have an owner's policy, so he's not considered a named insured of any policy here.
Well, counsel, I understand that you're going to ask this court to say that he is not a named insured. And the questions that I have now is, and this goes to the confused nature, I guess, of this case, is why do we even have to answer that question? Because I think the Supreme Court of North Dakota has assumed that. The reason that I think they have assumed that is because they have asked us to decide whether or not this policy is, or this clause, is a valid exclusionary clause under 632. Section 632. But if he's not a named insured, we never reach the question of whether this is a valid policy under 632. Isn't that correct?
It's a different twist on the issue, one that I honestly have not viewed before.
Well, think it through for me, because, I mean, if he's not a named insured, then the exclusions of 632 don't apply. Isn't that correct? It seems to me that even though they didn't say it, the North Dakota court has to be assuming that he's a named insured for purposes of their question. After all, whether he is a named insured or not is not a question of law. It's a question of interpretation of the insurance contract. And they are as capable as we are of interpreting this contract. So why do we even I guess it's a roundabout way of getting, you know, why do we even reach or discuss an issue of whether he's a named insured? I mean, maybe I'm wrong here in all this, but it seems to me that maybe the way we should go about approaching this case is saying, okay, assuming he's a named insured, as the North Dakota court quite obviously must have assumed, the question is whether or not this is a valid exclusion under 632, and then go ahead and answer that question.
If the court, the North Dakota court concluded that he is a named insured under the National Union policy, I guess I would agree with you that they're...
But didn't they implicitly have to? Because if he's not a named insured, we don't reach 632 questions.
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think that it was not the way I read the case that they answered the question that he is a named insured under the policy, and I would submit that that is, would be the wrong interpretation of the policy. And
well, it might be, but it seems to me that we're not here to determine whether he's a named insured, because that requires an interpretation of an insurance contract, and North Dakota court is perfectly capable of determining that.
The way that the issue had been couched and argued and has been whether or not he is named insured, and I submit to the court that if you read the policies, they are plain and ambiguous on their face that he's not an even insured. And the one phrase or the one aspect of the policy that has been the focus of Mao's argument is on Appendix 189, and that is Endorsement 1 to the excess policy.
Okay, counsel, you've answered, you know, you can't answer it, and that's perfectly understandable. So, but assuming, indulge me for a moment, assuming that I'm right, then it seems to me the big hurdle that you have to overcome is that Blazikowicz case. Could you address that? Because Blazikowicz seems to say on its face that these, as to a named insured, these type of exclusionary clauses are not valid. Blazikowicz wasn't driving her own car. She was a passenger in an emergency vehicle. And we found, and we threw out the exclusion.
I think it's different. I don't think Blazikowicz is directly on point here because that was specifically a drive other car exclusion, and what it said is you have personal and portable coverage under every circumstance except for this very one little circumstance where you're driving an emergency vehicle. And this court concluded that if you're going to have a drive other car exclusion, there's only one narrow circumstance where you can have such an exclusion, and that is if you own the other vehicle, is not registered, or it is registered in your name or some family member, and it does not appear on the policy. Can't do it just for emergency vehicles. But I agree with you, where you're going is that this would be thrown out, but for reasons other than Blazikowicz, drive of the car exclusion, I think it's thrown out by a public policy statement made by this court in its interpretation of the mandatory nature of uninsured motorist protection.
This is underinsured, isn't it?
This is underinsured, and that's...
I guess
I'm not entirely agreeing because under Dauhauer, arguably, this court has said that insurance companies, because underinsured motorist coverage is not defined by statute, insurance companies are free to define it in the policies as they wish.
And the problem you have with this case, I think, is unlike in Wisconsin, where you have an underinsured coverage policy and an uninsured policy, and uninsured you have to have under statute, underinsured you don't have to have. And then you've got these other states who have uninsured motorist coverage and define uninsured motorist coverage to include when you're hit by a negligent underinsured driver. So it's an uninsured motorist coverage policy that we have here that includes as part of that definition. How do you define uninsured motorist coverage? And they include underinsured as part of that definition.
That is how this policy, and I don't remember if it did that way by operation of the underlying or if it's just the excess policy, but you're right that they said it in underinsured.
We've run into that in this last term in a couple of cases too, other states defining it differently than.
But I don't think that because the policy defines an uninsured motorist to include an underinsured motorist that for that reason alone, this court has to apply uninsured mandatory required coverage law to the policy.
Counsel, I'm looking at page 106 of the appendix in reference to North Dakota. And North Dakota Supreme Court places great emphasis on endorsement number one to the excess policy, which defines insured as, quote, only while occupying the Alamo rental vehicle. Right?
Yes.
And that isn't a while they're getting in or out, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
That is not the definition of occupant of getting in or out of the vehicle. This is very limited. It says occupying. This is for the purpose of named insured.
I'm
at 106. I'm at the bottom of the page, right above the footnote.
Right. I see what you're saying there. And I don't know if this answers your question, but appendix page 193, the word occupying is defined in what, and that is the four-page uninsured motorist coverage endorsement to the excess.
That's in or out, right? Occupying, okay. But the point is that there's another definition for insured that limits, I understand this, and I'm not going to bet on that at the moment, that limits insured to only while occupying, right? Therefore, do we all agree, or do you agree, that he was not occupying the car at the time of injury?
I've argued to this court that he was not occupying the...
Pardon me?
Yes, I have argued that he is not occupying the vehicle, of course.
Period. Let's not talk about it, whether he's in or out, but he's not occupying it. Aren't they asking here whether you, if you limit the named insured to just the occupant of a vehicle, that that violates 632.32? Isn't that what they're asking?
They're asking.
Those paragraphs. Or have I... Pardon me?
The named insured.
Yes, they're asking whether a guy is not occupying it, occupying the car, is that person, and that a person under the policy is not a named insured, is that valid under 632.32? If that's not what they're asking, you ought to correct my misinterpretation and misimpression.
I think that is one interpretation, and one that has not been argued in the briefs, and one that I did not truly read when I understood the issues that came to me into this court.
So you had problems with understanding the certified question?
I didn't think so. I didn't read the decision as saying we've already found he's a named insured, therefore this is our only question.
But do you think the question is whether he's a named insured?
I think that is part of the question in this case. I think as part of the analysis, it has to go into the ultimate
What's
answer.
What's the other part?
That's the primary part. And the other
that
part...
That is 632.32 comes into play?
And that is the other part of it, whether 632 comes into play. And it certainly could if the court is going to interpret him as purchasing a named insured owner's policy. But that is, again, a rewriting of the contract between these parties, and I think a result that is unreasonable, arguably absurd, and not intended by the legislature nor the parties. What has occurred here is National Union understood that it was issuing a fleet policy to a rental car company. Mao understood that he was purchasing coverage on a limited basis. The rental contract even says the words occupying. He didn't believe that he was going to get out of this car and get into somebody else's car and have coverage no matter what car or vehicle he's driving, no matter where in the country. He understood that he was going to go to a foreign country and he was going to get into a rental car and he wanted some coverage for this rental car. That is what he intended. That is what Alamo intended. And that is what National Union intended throughout its policy. And I think for this court to endorse the concept that by simply paying this small additional fee, and that is the only distinguishing feature from the Reed and the Meyer cases, is a small fee. And I thought on my way up coming here that it is going to be a tough one for me to argue, perhaps a hurdle, but I've come up with, I think, another way for the court to look at it. Let's say, you know, in Reed we have an employee. Let's say the employees get together and they say to the employer, you know, boy, you've provided us with the statutory minimum coverage. Instead of giving us the jelly of the month present for Christmas or a small raise, what we would like to see is for you to provide us with additional coverage while we're driving your vehicles. Now, there may not be a direct fee paid by them, but it is understood that all those employees are going to be covered. And I think it's arguable that that is some form of consideration. Are those employees now going to be considered named insured for the employer's fleet policy, thereby distinguishing it from Reed? I don't think so. And the same thing applies here. The word gratuitous has been thrown out regarding some of the other cases that have been cited to this court. Alamo has to, by this state's law, provide a policy of liability which carries uninsured motorist coverage for Mao. Don't for a second think that even though there is not a separate fee paid for that initial coverage, we're not talking about the EP or the IEP coverage, but for that initial coverage that is mandated by state law, certainly Mao and every other renter may not be paying a separate fee, but they are absorbing the cost of that policy that had to be purchased by Alamo from National Union. And so there's always some consideration for renters. And I don't think that because Mao decides, okay, I've got some initial coverage, I want a little extra coverage, so I'm going to pay $2 or $3 more per day, it transforms the excess policy into a named insured policy when it does not do the same for the underlying policy which you had automatically.
There are no other questions, Mr. Wells. Thank you for your argument, Mr. I'm sorry, Justice Sykes.
About your position on the Danbeck issue.
I hurriedly went through the policy again this morning, and I discussed it with Mr. Harry, the attorney in North Dakota. We don't believe that the policy has an exhaustion clause which would invoke the Danbeck.
I found one.
You did?
Well, what I think is an exhaustion clause,
okay.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it's the endorsement for the UMUIM, Appendix 191, Paragraph A2. Which says we will pay only after all liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by judgments or payments, which I believe brings into play the Danbeck issue since the...
Sorry, was it A2? Did you say Justice?
191, and it's paragraph A2.
Right. If the insurance provides a limit in excess of the amounts required by law...
Which it does. This is a $1 million policy, right?
Covered auto is principally garaged. You will pay only after all liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by judgment or payments.
The $100,000 policy of the other driver was exhausted, but the $1 million policy of the city or county was not exhausted, right?
In all honesty, I don't know why that wasn't pursued further at the North Dakota court level, if that was viewed as language not strong enough, or if I honestly don't know the answer to that question. However, I did want to raise, and I did in my brief raise, I thought a related question is whether the Sukala, the Taylor, and the Dauhauer cases, which endorse the idea that a policy may prescribe a maximum amount of recoverable limits for any person, applies by operation of this policy. And I think that is applicable here because this policy does define underlying limits as do not include just the underlying policy in this case or an underlying self-insured retention over which the excess policy may be written, but it includes all policies recoverable for any accident. And so I think those cases, which came about in about the time when this case was being decided in North Dakota, I think they're all 2,000 cases, apply to see that the most that you can recover in any circumstance is $1 million. And that's all that we guarantee you. So at a minimum, Mao has already received $815,000. And so the maximum, I think, recoverable in this case would be $185,000, even if the court concluded in favor of the plaintiff.
Justice Babbage.
If I did my math bad, I apologize.
In order to answer the question of whether or not Mao was a named insured, don't we necessarily have to answer the question as to whether or not he was an occupant based upon the definition of insured under that endorsement? It starts off, who is an insured? Only while occupying the Alamo rental vehicle.
I answer your question, no. There's a distinction between a named insured, which is the person who appears on the declarations page as purchasing the policy. What endorsement 3 is, and I think that's from what you're reading, is, you know, who is insured. That is standard language.
I'm reading from endorsement 1.
Okay. endorsement one, that is language, that's additional insured language in any policy. So named insureds are typically the owner who appears on the declarations page and his or her family members. Additional insureds are anyone with the permission, anyone with who is legally responsible for operation of, or in this case, anyone who is occupying, who is a renter or lessee. That is additional insured as opposed to named insured.
North Dakota court says, reads further than you do, Justice Babbitt, is only while occupying, and this is all in quotes, a vehicle, any rentee lessee who purchases, but only when the Alamo vehicle is being driven by the rentee lessee. So does that whole clause, rentee lessee, apply here?
I believe so. I guess I'm not sure I followed the question.
Well, they don't limit it to while occupying any vehicle. It's only when occupying the vehicle, any rentee lessee who purchases the option, but only while the Alamo vehicle is being driven by the rentee lessee.
I think that's...
So it's a drive clause.
I think it's two requirements.
You have to occupy and you have to be driving.
Well, it has to be driven by someone who is considered an insured under
lessee.
The policy. It can't be driven by a non-permissible user.
Right. It can't just be a passenger who with an unauthorized driver.
That's what the policy states, yes.
So you have to look at occupy and whether they were driving.
Them or another additional authorized user, yes.
All right. Any other questions? Justice Wilcox, do you have a question? Again, thank you, Attorney Wells, for your argument. And we have 5 minutes of rebuttal by Wise. Mr. Wise, should we send this back and say we don't understand what they're talking about?
I don't know if that would be an option that they would appreciate, Chief Justice. Let me go over a couple of things, if I might. First of all, with respect to whether or not this court should decide the occupancy issue or whether that's a jury question, here I think this court should decide it because there's a stipulation as to the facts. The facts here are absolutely undisputed. So it's a clear question where the court needs to apply the law to those facts. If we were not dealing with a set of stipulated facts, I think that might differ. But everybody here agrees as to what those facts are. So I don't think it's one that the court can dodge.
So should we dodge it by defining occupant instead of named insured?
I'm sorry.
Let's not go through it again. You didn't get very much of a chance to argue named insured. Do you want to do that?
Yes, I would like to do that briefly. This is why I believe that he's named insured. Unlike the other cases that have been cited, there is no question that Mr. Mao purchased this policy. He received a rental contract with his name on it. He knew he was procuring the insurance through National Union. That, in my judgment, in and of itself would make him a named insured. But there's more. Alamo is clearly an agent for National Union and a disclosed agent because in their rental contract, they explicitly refer to National Union and let you know that that's where you're getting your insurance from. There is some reference in the brief that it says that this is not an application for insurance. It's right, it's not. It's a binder for insurance. Once you purchase it through Alamo, Alamo has an agreement with National Union that Mr. Mao knows at the time he purchases that insurance that once he signs on the dotted line, he's got the insurance. National Union has promised to provide that to him, and that's the deal that they had with Alamo.
How do you think this is a fleet policy? In other words, we just going through the policy moments ago, and under a fleet policy, Alamo is the name insured under a fleet policy. And I'm just looking at under the Meyer case. You're familiar with Meyer?
Yes.
Okay. It would seem that it would allow or only allow the corporate entity, in this case Alamo, to be the insured. But you're saying no, That's not true.
Well, I think it's wrong to call this a fleet policy for the purposes of this argument, because the fleet policy...
The reason I did is because that's what it is in the appendix. It's a fleet policy.
I understand that, but when we take a look at Meyer, in all of these cases that use the fleet policy argument, what's happened is that Mr. Meyer just happened to be insured under that policy by virtue of driving that car. He never had anything to do with procuring the policy, never had anything to do with getting it. He's insured because he's in the car, and it is, in fact, gratuitous. Here, Mr. Mao's policy, in my judgment, is not, you know, the underlying policy may be, quote-unquote, called a fleet policy, but Mr. Mao would not have coverage had he not taken affirmative action to procure it. And that's what I think the distinction is, and the most important distinction between all of those cases. This policy does not exist if Mr. Mao does not pay the premium and explicitly ask for the coverage.
And okay, so you're asking us to interpret the contract and find that he's a named insured.
Sure, I think...
Why isn't the North Dakota court the more appropriate body to determine that?
Well, I think it's a question.
Are they really asking us to interpret to determine that whether he's a named insured in a contractual interpretation?
Or are they asking us, assuming he is not covered as a named insured, is that a violation of 632.32?
To be brutally frank, and with the hope that this tape does not reach the North Dakota court, I think the North Dakota court, to a large extent, missed the ball here. But I think that they understood that they missed the ball, or that they might be, by putting the broad language at the end of the certification that basically says, you folks reformulate that in any way you see fit and tell us in your judgment how you believe Wisconsin law applies here. You know, and I believe that that's what the court should do. Any other action on the part of the court would be, to some extent, frankly, disingenuous. If we allow this court to make an assumption that the North Dakota court is making, an assumption that is contrary to Wisconsin law, we're not doing any service to the court. I'm sorry, I think I stepped on Justice Bradley and I didn't mean
to. That's okay. No problem. No problem.
Justice Wilcox, you had had a question during the primary argument, and I wanted to direct you particularly to those portions of the brief that deal with this. I do believe that he is a named insured just under the strict reading of the contract. And if I could, in our primary brief, that's at pages 5, 6, and 7, and then in our reply brief at page 3 in the footnote, again, that argument is outlined in more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Your time has expired. I want to thank both counsel, Mr. Weiss and Mr. Wells, for appearing today.